Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The White House announced on Monday that it would host an unusual private briefing for the entire Senate on North Korea. The briefing is set for today and follows up on massive live fire drills by North Korea's military in celebration of its 85th anniversary yesterday and in anticipation of what the Trump administration plans in light of apparent progress on North Korea's nuclear and missile programs. Coming up, the history of U.S.-North Korea relations. Joining us now for the latest is national security reporter for The Washington Post, Dan LaMoth. Welcome back, Dan.
Good to hear from you. Thank you.
The location of the briefing today has puzzled Senate staffers. Did it puzzle the media as well? What's going on there?
It was certainly an unconventional move to have it at the White House rather than having it on the Hill, and partly just logistically. I mean, you're talking, that's a large group of people. When you start talking senators and buses, and also assumedly this will certainly be a classified briefing at least at times, you need a space where you can have that much information aired in a classified setting where it's, held pretty tightly.
Does anyone know why they didn't just hold it on the Hill?
There really hasn't been a straight answer on that as of yet. I think the assumption is that the president may drop in. It's not expected he will be there necessarily for the full time, so I think it may have been convenience for the administration. But I think there's also a certain showbiz quality to doing it there rather than on the Hill as typical.
Is it typical at all to have the entire Senate involved in a briefing like this?
It's not something I've heard of much. It's very typical to have certain committees, receive briefings like this. To have a couple dozen senators at a time focused on a specific, intelligence or national security issue, that would be common. But to do it this big and in this location is uncommon.
So what is expected from this briefing today with the U.S. Senate and White House, a panel of, it looks like, military briefers?
Yes. So Secretary Mattis from the Pentagon, among others, will be briefing General McMaster as well, Trump's national security advisor. And I think they're looking to provide, A, an update on really what the situation is at this point, and B, where things may go. I think it's partly just laying out the facts as they are and then also sort of trying to forecast what senators should expect. I think this is in part there's an attempt here, I think, to get everybody on the same page. I think it's fair to say there's been some messaging problems when you look at the questions over where the U.S. Carl Vinson was, for example, the aircraft carrier that sounded like it was on its way to the Korean Peninsula, and it took a rather long detour in the opposite direction for a period of better than a week. Mm-hmm. So when you've got everybody saying essentially the same wrong thing in public, that's something, especially with a sensitive situation like this, that they're trying to get away from.
Well, it sounds like those kinds of gaffes have been on the side of the White House, not the U.S. Senate.
Yes, but at the same time, you also end up with, they are certainly asked their opinion on a variety of subjects. They certainly, some of these senators have quite a bit of juice themselves. Mm-hmm. So I think especially, somebody who tends to be rather pragmatic like Secretary Mattis, I think he's just trying to level with some of these folks in private and let them know where things are.
President Trump on Monday told members of the United Nations Security Council that they should be prepared to pass far more restrictive sanctions, which might include shutting off energy supplies. What do we know about whatever kind of reaction came out of that?
North Korea is certainly not happy with the general direction of thing over the last few weeks. You're hearing it in their rhetoric. You're also hearing it and seeing it with things like the live fire drill that they've been doing over the last several days. There's certainly concern over how they may react. There's concern that they may run another nuclear test at some point soon. And really, I think the effort, particularly from the Pentagon right now, is to not do anything rash and kind of pull back and look at this as more of part of a 30-year effort rather than, stepping on their necks now and potentially regretting the consequences.
Right. I mean, what triggered this sudden sense of urgency about North Korea in the last few weeks?
I think it's one of several things. I think it's, for one, you've got a new sets of eyes on this issue. Mm-hmm. And I think there's the sense that this was something that was a problem right along that needed to be addressed and would need to be addressed regardless who was president. President Obama, on his way out the door, was known to have told President Trump that North Korea in particular was a concern to him and something that would potentially be, you know, sort of a defining issue for him. So I don't think it's necessarily only that we've swapped administrations here. With that said, I think there is an effort to be a bit more strict and be tougher on, you know, adversaries everywhere. And North Korea is certainly one of those.
We're talking about U.S.-North Korea relations right now. My guest is Washington Post national security reporter Dan Lamothe. Coming up, we're going to look at the history of U.S.-North Korea relations. If you have a question or comment about what's going on right now, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. The president talked with China's president, Xi Jinping, on Sunday night. Jinping said is said to have urged restraint on President Trump's part. A New York Times story said that Trump aides are trying to use the president's unpredictability to an advantage. How does keeping China off balance deter North Korea?
I think the key issue here is China is really the only country that has a lot of leverage on North Korea at this point. You know, you can increase sanctions, you can do all these things, and they're all very incremental. China, at this point, has regular relations, regular business in North Korea, and they're one of, if not the only, you know, significant country to do so. So when you look at what China can do, you know, without any kind of military action, you know, if China were to say, all right, we're going to stop, you know, sending you this or buying, you know, your natural resources, those sorts of things. North Korea's economy is already very shaky. They've got a lot of leverage. So I think Trump is trying to urge China in particular to do more to push North Korea. So far, those efforts have been, you know, I think very much on the margins. And, you know, really the big question is what changes and how.
The U.S. really can't engage militarily with North Korea, right?
That's been the big question, particularly after the strike in Syria, because the concern has long been that if you run any kind of operation into Syria, into North Korea, you run the risk of them responding with some sort of ballistic missile attack, be it, you know, nuclear or conventional. But then in addition to that, they have hundreds of pieces of artillery, perhaps more, that are within range of Seoul, the capital of South Korea. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you're talking about a potentially catastrophic event if they were to, you know, start firing these, you know, pieces of artillery, you know, in sequence. Mm-hmm. And the United States could get to some of them and, you know, staunch the attack eventually. But a lot of these are hidden in caves and, you know, inside the mountains of North Korea, and we can't find them right now. So you simply cannot stop an attack of that sort, at least without, you know, major casualties and major fatalities in Seoul in that area.
And that would include U.S. fatalities.
Yes. I mean, there are tens of thousands of American troops and families in that area. I mean, it's not even just the troops themselves. I mean, that's an area where, you know, you are allowed to have what they call accompanied tours. And, you know, you've got husbands and wives and children that are there as well.
Has South Korea weighed in very much on all of this? Or are they just sort of sitting and waiting for these superpowers to do their due diligence?
South Korea definitely is. I think they are obviously way more concerned on a number of levels than the United States is. You know, the United States is very concerned about this problem. This is, you know, this is straight up scary if you're living in South Korea, particularly along that border right now. I spent some time in South Korea last fall, and I was really struck even back then, prior to sort of this, you know, more recent escalation, of just how much, you know, this is in the psyche of South Koreans.
Yeah, we forget about that. When was the last time that they opened up the border and had some kind of meeting between families and that kind of a thing?
It's been years at this point. It was something that they there was a period of time where they were open to, you know, some level of discussion. But, you know, in the last several years, South Korea cut it off almost entirely. So that there is not even the amount of dialogue that there once was.
Who does the U.S. talk to when it's talking to North Korea?
That's actually an excellent question, because I think there are very few people there. There's not the level of dialogue that the United States has with other adversaries.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, even with a country like Russia, there is regular dialogue and visits and things of that sort. The United States simply does not have that in North Korea.
So we don't know who's talking to who then?
It's not very clear and specific, no.
Hmm. So what are you looking for today, Dan Lamoth? How much do you think you're going to get out of this briefing as a member of as a journalist?
I think there's a couple things to watch for today. One will be the reaction of senators coming out. People like Senator McCain will certainly weigh in on this. Another thing that's also in play this week is Harry Harris, the four-star admiral for Pacific Command, is testifying on the Hill today in front of the House Armed Services Committee, tomorrow in front of the Senate Armed Services Committee. He has been rather forward and aggressive toward China in the past. So one thing we're watching is whether or not he kind of steps off some of that rhetoric now that, the Trump administration seems to need China more, more specifically on the North Korean threat. And then there's also, the idea of, what kind of explanations and details might come out as the admiral testifies and is questioned on kind of the direction of things.
After one of these kinds of briefings, they are classified. Do people like Senator McCain say much about what they've learned?
I mean, obviously they have restrictions because mm-hmm. what's classified, they will remain so, at least barring mistakes. But in terms of they can offer opinions, they can offer, thoughts on what they heard as long as they don't get specific about, the details of that briefing.
Do you have a sense, I don't know about you, but, you're there, we're out here in, the hinterland. People aren't really talking much about this issue.
Yeah, I think North Korea is something that it's difficult for a lot of Americans to wrap their arms around. I think it's commonly known that they've got an erratic leader and that they're working on a nuclear program. But when you start talking about some of the things that have come up, over the last several decades, I mean, there have been several North Korean, invasions or, at least small, several dozen soldiers kind of thing pushes across the border. There have been firefights in South Korea with North Korean soldiers. Just a couple years ago, there were a couple of South Korean soldiers that stepped on landmines that certainly appear to have been laid on the South Korean side of the DMZ by North Korea. So, I mean, all these things are, just these small attacks, these small raids, things of that sort. There's always the risk and the concern that one of those things could be, sort of the last straw or something that sparks a much larger fire.
Dan Lamoth, thanks again for joining us. I really appreciate your time today.
Glad to.
Dan Lamoth, national security reporter for The Washington Post. More about the U.S.-North Korea relations, the history leading up to the present. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The White House announced Monday that it will host an unusual private briefing on North Korea for the entire Senate. The briefing is set for today and follows up on a massive live fire drill by live fire drills by North Korea's military in celebration of its 85th anniversary and in anticipation of what the Trump administration plans in light of apparent progress in North Korea's nuclear and missile programs. We just heard from Washington Post National Security reporter Dan Lamoth about the latest news. Now we want to talk about the history leading up to the present state of tension between the U.S. and North Korea. Joining us is Ohio State University historian and director of the Institute for Korean Studies, Mitchell Lerner. Welcome back.
Hi, Ann. Happy to be here.
Also by phone, professor of Korean studies at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, Sung Yoon Lee. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Professor Lee, how were things left after the Korean War ended in 1953?
In a stalemate. No one really won the war except for North Korea's claim that it was victorious. And each year, North Korea celebrates with pomp and ceremony the Armistice Signing Day, which is July 27th. And I think that's in one way a reminder of the unfinished business of liberating the South, that is, communizing the entire Korean Peninsula. When we talk about North Korea, seldom do we pay attention to the internal dynamic in the Korean Peninsula. Basically, you have two Korean states, each claiming to be the sole legitimate representative of the entire Korean nation. And in this contest, I think much of the world will agree that South Korea has won. It is much more attractive, more successful, more prosperous, more pleasant. And that has implications for the Kim regime. The sheer existence of the South Korean state presents an existential challenge to North Korea. So military power, nuclear blackmail, these are not a lifestyle choice. They're not an option for the Kim regime, but the real means, perhaps the only panacea, the only means to by which to prevail over the more successful South Korea one day.
How did North Korea get so shut off? What decisions did it make back in 1953 that led to this isolation?
Well, North Korea is relatively isolated, of course, but literally speaking, it is not hermetic or isolated.
Okay.
It maintains diplomatic relations with many countries, but it is the most isolated major nation state in the world by choice. And the reasons are quite complex, but the obvious ones are North Korea, the regime is totalitarian, it is illegitimate, it is very brutal, it shows little regard for human life. Kim Jong-il in the 90s, according to a major UN study on human rights in North Korea, allegedly starved people to death. It was a policy of deliberate mass starvation. So they have an incentive to keep things out, information out of the country, also to block information flow out of the country to the outside world. So they're very adept in information blockade and strategic deception.
Mitchell Lerner, what was Korea like before the war? What was a unified Korea?
Well, it's funny because we in the United States tend to think of the two Koreas. We think of it as this longstanding divided nation. But the reality is this is one nation for centuries. And it's really not until the World War II period when the rivalry between communism and capitalism emerges that in the wake of the destruction of World War II and Korea becomes one of those classic nations where the question is going to be after the war, are you going to be allied with the West or are you going to be allied with the Communist Soviet Union? And what happens in that critical period of 1945 to 1950 is the nation gets divided. The United States chooses a couple American military colonels, actually somewhat arbitrarily, choose the 38th parallel to divide the nation. And they set up an American pro-American government in the South, largely because they wanted access to the port city of Incheon in the South. Communists set up a government in the North. And there's a kind of a critical power struggle for the next 5 years. We in the West tend to think of the Korean War as breaking out in 1950, and of course,
yeah,
by our standards, that's true. But between 1945 and 1950, there's about 100,000 Koreans on either side of the border who are killed in political-related fighting, as each side is kind of struggling to reunite the country under the rule of one side or the other. And then it kind of becomes official in 1950. The Korean War sort of hardens these divided lines. It brings the superpowers involved. And for the next, you know, series of decades, Korea becomes this flashpoint. And I think it has particular resonance now as we talk about the tension that we see emerging in the Korean Peninsula now. And everyone is up in arms about how dangerous this situation is. And it absolutely is. But it's also not entirely unprecedented. We've had conflicts with North Korea. As Dr. Lee said, there's just an armistice that ends the war. There's not an official peace treaty. And so the relationship between the United States and the North is one of tension and conflict. We actually almost have a second Korean War in 1968. When North Korea captures an American spy ship, they kill a couple of people, they hold about 80 men hostage, they shoot down an EC-121 spy plane in 1969, which kills 31 Americans. There's pretty severe tensions in 1976 when they kill a number of Americans and American soldiers who are going tree trimming in to cut down a tree in the demilitarized zone. In 1994, we have kind of a critical moment when the United States is incredibly close. I don't think Americans appreciate how close we were to war in 94. President Clinton is actually in the White House being briefed on military options to take out this nuclear plant in Yongbyon, and by all accounts was likely to approve the steps necessary that might have included cruise missile strikes on the plant that would have led down a path towards war, most likely. And then Jimmy Carter, I think, unfortunately, and to the frustration of the administration, kind of intervened with a treaty. So this is a long history that dates all the way back to the 1940s of tension and rivalry and hostility that's brought us to this point. And what's changed now, and Dr. Lee can certainly speak to this, but what's changed now is I think we have a little bit more unpredictability at the top with Kim Jong-un and President Trump, both of whom maybe are a little bit less experienced and a little bit more flamboyant and bellicose. And then, of course, there's the possession of the much more advanced weapon systems that North Korea has now.
Hmm. Yeah, Sung-Yoon Lee, what about Korea left it so vulnerable to that separation, that collision between the ideologies of communism and capitalism?
Well, Korea was Japan's colony for much of the first part of the 20th century, so Korea had no identity on the world stage from 1910 to 1945. So you have a generational long displacement, no experience in self-government, Koreans as second-class Japanese citizens really cut off from the rest of the world until the end of the Second World War and liberation, largely delivered courtesy of the United States by virtue of the U.S. victory over Japan. So in that power vacuum, you have the U.S. and the USSR, the principal victors, dividing the Korean Peninsula. Again, of course, it was to be a temporary division, but, you know, some 70 years later, it's still here. The two Korean nations, in the meantime, pursued very different paths of national development. South Korea was heavily aid-dependent on the U.S., and for strategic reasons, the U.S. Gave generously to South Korea and committed itself to the defense of South Korea. North Korea was dependent on the former Soviet Union and China and the Soviet bloc nations, and actually fared pretty well in terms of rapid industrialization. North Korea outpaced the economy of South Korea until about the mid-1970s. But then things went really downhill, starting in the mid-70s, first with the oil shock of 1973. In the mid-1970s, North Korea had defaulted on every single loan and became credit unworthy. And also the South Korean economy really took off under a former military dictator, Park Chung-hee, in the 1970s. So, you know, this systemic contest, again, in the eyes of much of the rest of the world, is over. But this is a matter of survival for the North Korean state. And they've been at this game of developing a credible nuclear arsenal with a delivery system with which they can nuke a major city in the United States. I don't believe North Korea is crazy in a conventional way of speaking. I don't think the Kim regime is suicidal. I think they're very keen on self-preservation. So unlikely to lash out and start a war, one that they will lose. At the same time, you know, brinkmanship, graduated escalation, and nuclear threat and blackmail, these are the very means to long-term survival for the regime. And North Korea, therefore, is no joke. We used to laugh at North Korea. We tend to patronize North Korea because they're so different, you know, backward and bizarre, and they say outrageous things. We laughed when North Korea conducted its first nuclear test more than 10 years ago in 2006 because the yield was so low. No one's laughing now in the wake of North Korea's most recent test, which came in September last year. The yield reportedly on that was about the same as the U.S. bomb dropped on Hiroshima in 1945, which, of course, was devastating, and experts, you know, are forecasting that the next nuclear test may be 20 times, 30 times more powerful. So no one's laughing now. And I think there is belatedly a sense of urgency in the Trump administration that the old ways of half-hearted sanctions and dithery diplomacy have not been effective, and that a new approach must be taken. And I think the Trump administration is trying to put a lot of pressure on China to rein North Korea in more, to exercise its potential leverage against North Korea, because North Korea is so aid-dependent, heavily dependent on China. At the same time, you know, these messages exhorting the Chinese, resorting to moral suasion, you're a great power, responsible stakeholder, really over the past 20 years have fallen on deaf ears, because the Chinese have very different national interests from the United States.
Mm-hmm. You know, going back to what Professor Kim said, or Professor Lee said about the mid-1970s, the oil shock to North Korea, the economy started to fall apart. I was wondering about that, because in 1972, North and South Korea issued a joint statement on peaceful reunification. And I was wondering, what was that, Professor Lerner, and what is that? Was that, did that fall victim to this economic crisis?
Yes, but this is fairly common. There are fits and starts in the relationship, and there have been going back for years. In the late 80s and early 90s, there was a brief moment, a number of brief moments of success and joint statements and pledges to denuclearize, de-weaponize the peninsula. Even in the wake of the 1994 crisis, there was a period where it looked like things were going down a much more positive road. I think by and large, this is really a reflection of North Korean internal politics and internal needs, and I don't think it's ever reflected any genuine commitment on their part.
Okay.
Because as Dr. Lee said, from the North Korean perspective, the nuclear deterrent, particularly in the current leadership, Kim Jong-un, I think maybe even more than his father and his grandfather who ruled before him, this is an absolute necessity. This is not something that he plans to give up. I think in the earlier years, there might have been a chance for some sort of bargain or some sort of trade to at least slow the weapons program down. Kim Jong-un seems pretty committed that he's going forward with this, and it's going to require some pretty firm steps to get him to stop. Dr. Lee talked about a couple things that I think are really relevant and on point here. Every time there's a North Korean crisis, as there is right now, and we've been through these for 50 or 60 years, mm-hmm. we hear a couple things from American politicians. And I think this is one of the greatest abdications of political responsibility that we've seen in our generation. What we hear over and over again are two things. First, we hear the Kim family is crazy. Which, of course, they are not. And you might say, well, you have to be at least some, I guess it depends your definition of crazy, right? They enslave their own people. They have killed and starved and brutalized millions of people. So you might define that as crazy. But from a standpoint of international relations, they've actually been pretty rational and predictable. So this notion that we can't deal with them because they're crazy, I think, is really just a cop-out and an excuse to not get involved. And that ties into the other point, which is that American politicians quickly point to China. And I think it's an abdication of responsibility. And over again, we've heard, this is China's problem. China has leverage. China has to get involved to stop it. I think that, first of all, the Chinese influence in North Korea is dramatically overstated, and I think the historical record shows that. But even if it isn't, the reality is this is a critical crisis for the American government. And to simply dismiss it, to have spent the last 10, 15 years just kind of expecting that we can wave a magic wand and China will do something for us and that will solve the problem, hasn't gotten us anywhere.
How did the leadership of Kim Jong-il, father of Kim Jong-un, change North Korea's trajectory, Sung Yoon Lee?
Well, the founder, the grandfather of the current leader, mm-hmm. died at the age of 82. It was a natural death in July 1994, just a few years after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the falling of the Berlin Wall, the crumbling of the Eastern Bloc, the Soviet Bloc nations. So, understandably, there was the expectation on the part of the U.S. government, the State Department, as well as many North Korea watchers, that North Korea would not survive. It will crumble, it will disappear, collapse and go away, and join the dustbin of history with the Soviet Empire in a few years, in the foreseeable future. So there was sort of a laissez-faire attitude even during the Clinton administration, until North Korea caught the world's attention with its first ever long-range missile test over Japan in 1998. Kim Jong-il took over in 1994 in the wake of his father's death. We knew very little about him. He was more reclusive. He seldom traveled abroad. He had not studied abroad. He was known to be a hard drinker, partied hard. He was a playboy. He liked James Bond films. So we had these silly stereotypes of him as somewhat incompetent, and the assumption was he would not be able to hold the system together. For various reasons, he's been quite, resilient, and he was in power until he died in late 2011. And during that 17-year-long reign, Kim Jong-il took his nation on, you know, down the nuclear path. So Kim Jong-il became quite widely known outside the Korean Peninsula. Perhaps he was the most famous ethnic Korean individual during those years in the 90s and 2000s outside the Korean Peninsula. His son, the current leader, I would say, as silly as it sounds, is by far the most widely recognized by name and face Korean in the modern world. And, you know, that is one snapshot of the bizarre dynamic in the Korean Peninsula, where on the south, you have a model successful state, a world leader in shipping and electronics, a thriving democracy. In North Korea, a model failed state, if you will, a brutal dictator presiding over a nation of 25 million hungry people. Yet, he gets all the attention.
And yet, it's interesting that they coexist the way they do, and that South Korea, its ups and downs economically, notwithstanding in the last 15 years especially, but or 20 years, I should say. How does a nation like South Korea manage to be so successful when just across, you know, a few miles away is their greatest adversary? It seems like it's not a great risk, but you mentioned it's just an incredible shipping operation as well.
Yeah, may I draw your attention to two points with respect mm-hmm. to this question. How does South Korea manage to survive and even thrive yeah. in the face of continual North Korean threat? There's an element of denial, and I think it's sort of a defense mechanism. Within South Korea, if you live in constant fear of a North Korean attack, you can't really function as a society. So there is this sort of illusion that the North Korean nuclear issue is principally the great powers' issue, it's America's issue, and the U.S. should resolve it. They don't really mean us harm with their nuclear weapons. They have conventional artillery with which they can wreak havoc in the entire Korean Peninsula. So there is an element of denial there. More importantly, I think the fact that South Korea has really developed its economy, its society from the ashes of the Korean War to what it is today, I think South Korea is the world's 11th largest economy. You know, it's not in the top tier of advanced wealthiest nations of the world, but yeah. it is quite wealthy. There's no one hungry in South Korea. This means that over the past six decades or so, South Korea has grown rich. South Korea has grown a bit complacent. There's simply too much on the line, and the South Korean public does not support escalation of tension with North Korea. That means that the North Korean regime, the dictator in perpetuity, can take his time, has all the advantage when negotiating with South Korea, because even as North Korea provokes and resorts to, at times, lethal attacks against South Koreans and Americans in South Korea, there is extraordinary self-restraint exercised by both South Korea and the United States. Professor Lerner mentioned some key issues, incidents in the late 60s. Mm-hmm. In 1969, as Professor mentioned, North Korea shot down a U.S. spy plane in international airspace, killing all 31 U.S. servicemen. When, on Kim Il-sung's birthday, April 15th, early in the Nixon administration, what did Nixon do? Nothing in the end. Even as North Koreans were shooting down a U.S. helicopter in the summer of that year, in August, and holding three people as hostages, the Nixon administration apologized to win their release because Nixon could not prosecute two wars simultaneously in Asia, and North Korea knew it. So this goes back to the point that North Korea is not crazy. There's a pathology there, but, you know, a rational pathology, very calculating. North Korea knows just how far to push the envelope and has been able to get away with murder.
That is Professor Sung-Yoon Lee, Professor of Korean Studies at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. Also with us, historian and director of the Institute for Korean Studies at Ohio State, Mitchell Lerner. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We'll be right back. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The White House announced that it will host an unusual private briefing on North Korea for the entire Senate today. It follows up on a massive live fire drill by North Korea's military in celebration of its 85th anniversary and in anticipation of what the Trump administration plans in light of apparent progress on North Korea's nuclear and missile programs. We're talking about the history of U.S.-North Korea relations and how it relates to what's going on right now. Still with us, OSU history professor and director of the Institute for Korean Studies at OSU, Mitchell Lerner, and by phone, professor of Korean Studies at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, Sung Yoon Lee. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. What is really known, Mitchell Lerner, about Kim Jong-un? I mean, we heard Professor Lee say that he's rash. He knows what he's doing.
Right. It's surprising how little we actually know about him. There was a long time we weren't sure how old he was, and there was rumors about whether he had studied in Switzerland. And I think we've gotten maybe a little bit of a glimpse of who he is. In fact, so when he came to power, there was a big debate amongst Korean watchers as to whether or not he might change things, right? He had a much more pro-Western background, and we talked about him. You know, there were images of him dancing at Korean shows with Disney characters, and women were being allowed to dress in a more Western fashion, and he had a young wife who was seen dressed in Western clothing. So there was a brief window when people thought maybe this person will open the doors to the West and maybe put an end to some of the tensions. But in fact, he almost went in the other direction. Pretty soon, there was a dramatic crackdown on political prisoners. As most of your listeners probably know, North Korea has just about the worst system of political prison camps in the world.
It doesn't take much to get into one of those either.
In fact, not only can you go to these prison camps for things as inoffensive as not adequately dusting the photo of Kim Il-sung who's supposed to be on your wall or not wearing the button of Kim Il-sung that you're supposed to wear on your shirt all the time, but for certain types of crimes, not only can you go to these prisons, but three generations of your family goes with you. So it really is, and again, Dr. Lee had mentioned this as well, it's a brutal and reprehensible nation, and the new Kim has been just as exploitative and dictatorial and horrible as his father and grandfather, and some would argue even worse.
Yeah, Professor Lee, what about, are there any powers behind the throne that we know about?
I don't think so. It could happen. There's always a first time. So somebody may, you know, muster up the courage to get rid of Kim Jong-un one day. And that possibility, of course, is what drives Kim to be so dictatorial, the reign of terror. According to the South Korean intelligence service, Kim Jong-un has had over 300 senior people purged, executed over the past 5 years. But, you know, this is more business than personal. That is, North Korea operates like a giant criminal syndicate. So having your uncle or your half-brother killed to make the point, beware, don't you dare, you know, that's the North Korean way. So the expectation that Kim Jong-un, just by virtue of having lived in Switzerland as a boy, may be a reformer, I think was misplaced. You know, for every Deng Xiaoping who lived in France as a young man and did introduce major reform and opening policies for China in the early 1980s, for every Deng, there's a Pol Pot who lived in Paris as a young man in his 20s for 4 years. There's the Syrian dictator, Bashar al-Assad, who studied medicine in England. It's really the nature of the regime, the mono-hierarchical structure of North Korea, the Korean political culture, which is an imperial leadership, imperial presidency. I would say that's applicable even in the Democratic South as well. So much power concentrated in the single leader. There's no history really of collective leadership, and North Korea has taken this model to an extreme, of course. So I don't think North Korea is in a position to introduce reform opening. I don't think they can change because, again, they have to keep up with the Kims and the Lees, the Koreans in the South. They have to, you know, compete with South Korea. And in the long term, the more the North Korean people find out about the nature of their horrid, wretched existence and the dictatorial ways of their leadership, the more vulnerable the regime will be.
Yeah, and it's worth noting as well that it's a pretty limited number of people who support the regime, limited number of elites who are kind of tied to the regime and support the government. And so they're all sort of in this together, right? The idea of opening up to the West means if that government comes down, a lot of the people who might be in a position to replace Kim are equally guilty of war crimes and would be subject to some sort of prosecution themselves. So this is your classic example of they all hang together or they all hang separately.
Yeah. I have a Facebook message from Kevin who asks if there's an ethnic aspect to the North Korea-South Korea conflict, similar to the Sunni-Shiite or Israeli-Palestinian conflicts. Professor Lee?
Well, Koreans harbor wholeheartedly this myth that Korea is a so-called pure race. There is a high degree of ethnic homogeneity. So the answer is no. Korea has at least 2,000 years of recorded history and more than 1,000 years of history under which Korea remained united. There was no North Korea or South Korea to speak of until 1945. So a strong sense of shared historical experience, a shared future, sort of destiny, and a desire to be united. As an abstraction, you know, it's a taboo to come out and say we want perpetual division. So there's an element of ethnic nationalism which is quite powerful and which has implications across the border. Whenever Korea feels somewhat insulted by offhand remarks by late-night comedians or even by a U.S. president, when President Bush used the phrase axis of evil, even South Koreans took umbrage, took that as an insult against the collective Korean nation, the ethnic Korean nation. And whenever there is the message of doing things by Koreans ourselves, that is, addressing the issue of Korean unification by Koreans ourselves without intervention by Americans and the Chinese and so forth, that message resonates powerfully.
Yeah, one of the things I would add to that I think is interesting, absolutely everything he said is right, but I'm sensing there may be some changes in that dynamic coming. And one of the things I find most interesting about public opinion polls in Korea right now is the younger generation, for the first time, is starting to see the North Koreans as a separate entity. And they're not seeing that, you know, older generations looked at North and South Korea as one divided people. But the younger generation that's coming to power in South Korea really is starting to see North Koreans as almost a different people. And I think those homogeneous ties are starting to decline.
People are dying.
Right.
The ancestors that would remember
that. And the generation that's coming to power doesn't have that same memory. And part of what drives this, I think, is when we get North Korean defectors in the South, when they first started coming, they were really celebrated by the South. And the Southern people rallied behind them, and the government spent money on camps to train them and you know, get them involved in South Korean society. But over the years, they've started to see that as a little bit more of a drain. And their younger generation, while still, you know, supportive, has started to question the amount of money and resources that goes into this, and is certainly less enthusiastic about the number of defectors that are coming over now and would come over in the case of unification. So there is absolutely this sense of a united people, and there's been lots of literature about sort of the Korean ideology and how they define themselves as almost a pure and childlike race that is superior and easily manipulated by the deceitful Western powers. And yet I do think that there's this generational split that is going to impact policy in one way or the other, and I'm not sure how. But there is this recognition of the division of the people that is starting to infiltrate into politics.
Danny in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Danny.
Oh, hello. Professors and Ian, this seems crucial. I haven't heard anybody address it yet. When is our defense or our intelligence community, when are the best estimates of when North Korea will develop an ICBM that could reach our shores? And secondly, I'd like to know, would it matter who was the president? It almost seems like no president would be able to allow North Korea to advance that much, that they would have a solid fuel ICBM that could reach the West Coast. What does our intelligence community, what's their best estimate as to when this might happen?
Sorry about that, Danny. Mitchell Lerner?
Most intelligence estimates say it's 5 years
right
before they can hit the West Coast. I think
Seattle, they're saying.
Yeah. Now, I think that's probably, I guess I'd use the word optimistic, and I guess depends where you're sitting. It defines whether or not you see it as optimistic or pessimistic. I think that estimate might be a little bit more alarmist simply because the Obama administration seems to have successfully implemented a cyber warfare program, which has really hampered their missile tests. Their Musudan missile, which is one of their medium-range missiles, has about an 88% failure rate. And we suspend, although part of that is just human error and technological shortcomings. There's been clear efforts by the American intelligence community to slow the process down, so perhaps that will hinder them a little bit. Nevertheless, there are other factors that hint that North Korea might actually move more quickly than we think. And one is that, kind of ironically, they're so sort of contemptuous of their own people that they don't implement the standard safeguards that most powers moving towards nuclear development implement. So when the U.S. or other nations were moving in this direction, they made sure that all of their facilities had certain venting requirements and other things to preserve the health and the safety of their workers. And North Korea really shows no need to do that. So the general rule of thumb, I think we're looking at, is 4 to 6 years. As for the question of whether or not it matters who the president is, it's probably not, but not for the reasons that I think Danny suggests, which is that it's such a difficult issue. It's more that there's just no good options. Victor Cha, who used to be the Bush administration's top man on North Korea, once referred to North Korea as the nation of bad options. And he's right. There's not an easy option here. We can talk about a combination of economic sanctions and other pressures, which I think would certainly work to slow things down and need to be implemented. But nevertheless, we're in a position where it almost doesn't matter who the American leader is. Something difficult is going to have to be done.
Professor Lee, what should China's role be in all of this? We heard Mitchell Lerner say earlier that the U.S. has abdicated, you know, its role in this, and that it's not necessarily a good idea to leave it all to China to do the dirty work.
I think China is perfectly fine with its enormous political and economic influence over both North Korea and South Korea. Arguably, China today enjoys greater influence over the Korean Peninsula than at any time since the Opium War in the mid-19th century. So, yes, North Korea sometimes makes China look bad. North Korea is pesky. But, you know, this is nothing new. Sino-North Korean relations have gone through very rough patches in the past. In the mid-60s, they were reportedly even shooting at each other along the border. Both China and North Korea withdrew their ambassador from the other capital. Chinese Red Guards were calling Kim Il-sung, quote, a fat revisionist aristocrat, which is pretty harsh in communist parlance. So what I'm trying to say here is the Chinese don't really mind too much a problematic North Korea right next to it that is willing to do all the dirty work in terms of pressuring the United States, which is, of course, the bigger adversary, strategic competitor to China over the long term. And I think the way to get China on board, therefore, is to present China with an economic financial disincentive, that is, for the U.S. to raise the cost for China of continuing to coddle the Kim regime. How do you do that? Through what's called secondary sanctions, which is nothing radical or new. It's been tried with success several times in the post-9/11 era. Simply, you go after the primary target, its financial transactions, international financial transactions, North Korea, and also North Korea's third country partners, which means basically Chinese banks and enterprises and entities. You block those nations, those people, those agencies out of the U.S. dollar system, presenting those countries that are continuing to trade with North Korea with the option, do you want to do business with us, the U.S., or with North Korea? And the answer is usually pretty clear. China's biggest banks have voluntarily cut off money transfer with designated North Korean banks in the past. Will this lead to some kind of a trade war? Perhaps, but probably not. The Chinese act like adults. You know, Chinese banks and big companies are very mindful of financial costs, risks, and I think they will comply and even deviate from the stated government policy as they have shown to in the past.
Sung-Yoon Lee, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Sung-Yoon Lee is professor of Korean studies at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, and also Mitchell Lerner, history professor and director of the Institute for Korean Studies at OSU. Thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.